The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Well, it's an actual pivotal day for the markets around the world with the payroll figures due. We are live on Squawkbox from the shores of Lake Como. Myself, Steve Sedgwick, and the London studio, Mandy Drury and Arabile Gamede. These are your headlines. The Dow Jones Industrial Average sees its worst day in over a year and eyes up its worst week since March 2023, as the Minneapolis Fed President Neel Kashkari raises the possibility, wait for it, of no rate cuts this year.
If we continue to see inflation moving sideways, then that would make me question whether we needed to do those rate cuts at all.
What a backdrop for the jobs report, though. Coming into view with the markets, expecting payroll growth to slide to 200,000. I've seen some bigger estimates, though. 200,000 in March. Now, Nomura's chief economist, Richard Koo, had a brilliant conversation with him yesterday evening. He tells me here at the Ambrosetti Spring Forum, it's not the only risk for the Federal Reserve.
There's just so much excess reserves in the banking system. The amount of excess reserves in the U.S. banking system is more than 1,700 times larger than before the Lehman crisis.
President Biden warning Israel's leader that America's continued support for the war with Hamas depends on the treatment of civilians, calling the humanitarian situation in Gaza unacceptable.
Bob Iger looks to move on from his boardroom battle with activist Nelson Peltz, while the Trian Partners founder says he hopes the Disney CEO can keep his promises.
His presence on the board, the board believed, could be distracting, and that might have made it very, very difficult for us to do our jobs.
I'm willing to give them the opportunity to prove me wrong. I'm willing to give them the opportunity to do as they say.
And Samsung Electronics guides for a more than tenfold increase in its first quarter operating profit amid a rebound in global chip prices.
So the market picture has actually been looking towards just where do these rate cuts lie, right? Well, I mean, we'll head off to Lake Como in a bit and really have a further discussion when it comes to these interest rates. But really interesting that Fed speakers have been noting just simplistically here how, yes, they had initially priced in those three cuts initially. In fact, Neel Kashkari, Minneapolis Fed president, saying that he had priced in two rate cuts then for later this year at the last Fed meeting. And now that's changed. And he says, maybe we don't need one at all. Even Thomas Barking then even came out this yesterday as well, saying that maybe just one might be necessary. It would be very prudent then for the Fed to actually take its time as it looks towards this. Let's remember that it was in October last year when you got that pivot from the Fed saying we're sufficiently restrictive and things may remain higher for longer when it comes to that interest rate picture. And that's when markets began to rally on the back of news that things may not necessarily go towards a cut sooner rather than later for the markets. We've seen these big losses. That's what we got yesterday, more than 1% loss across the board. In fact, for the Dow Jones, it tumbled more than 500 points. That's the biggest drop since March 2023 then for the Dow Jones Industrial. 1.35% weaker at the close of yesterday's trade, the fourth consecutive session drop in a row. What has this all meant? Well, for week to date, we're down as well, quite significantly. Of course, you do have today to still look forward to, but you have that non-farm payrolls figure, right? 200,000 jobs are anticipated to have been added to the U.S. economy following 275,000 added in the month of February. So it tells you then that the data will determine where the markets also go. So it's not just the Fed that needs the data. Seems like the markets need it too. Onto the Treasury front then, well, Treasuries have certainly been moving high on the back of the anticipation that you might not get those interest rate cuts sooner, as soon as the markets perhaps had anticipated, or even as many as the market had anticipated. 4.3 is where you're sitting now, though, when it comes to that 10-year note. So it's actually dropped off from the 4.4 we had actually seen it at a little bit earlier this week. 4.64 on the bottom end then of the spectrum for the 2-year note is where we're sitting when it comes to that one. On to WTI as well as Brent. Now, the commodities picture has seen a significant growth then, particularly this year. In fact, even the likes of gold have moved higher, right? But really, when one takes a look just at the price then of oil, $86 a barrel, $86.69 in fact for WTI, that's up a tenth of a percent just today, right? 27 cents gain for Brent crude oil, now officially at $90 per barrel. Is $100 next is the big question mark. Yes, geopolitical tensions obviously still at play, plus of course stockpiles out of the United States. Onto the Asia market picture. Mainland China is still closed, but we are still looking across the board then. More than 2% lost across the board. This ultimately mimics a lot of what you're seeing out of the United States, right? The likes of Samsung Electronics, should I say, are the ones we will be looking out for when it comes to the Kospi as well, down more than 1%. Negativity though, across the board here. And again, it is all about the data, and the Fed doesn't look too keen on cutting rates too soon, Mandy.
You're absolutely right, Arabile. What a big day out there for the global markets, as Steve rightly said, as those the cards in the rate deck are being reshuffled. Well, let's take a look at one of the reasons why Richmond Fed President Thomas Barkin said that the Fed should take its time and wait to see whether inflation could reemerge. Barkin said a strong labor market should give the central bank, quote, time for the clouds to clear before beginning its rate-cutting cycle. Elsewhere, Minneapolis President Neil Kashkari said that inflation data from the first 2 months of the year was concerning, saying that he needs to see more progress on bringing it down before considering cuts. Well, Kashkari said there is a possibility the Fed does not cut rates at all this year.
In March, I had jotted down 2 rate cuts this year. Okay. If inflation continues to fall back towards our 2% target. But if we continue to see inflation moving sideways, then that would make me question whether we needed to do those rate cuts at all. There's a lot of momentum in the economy right now.
I'll just spend a second on this, because those Kashkari comments are absolutely fascinating, especially given the conversation I had with Richard Koo last night. I'm going to try and get as much Richard Koo sound out there as well. I make no bones about it, no apologies. He said so many amazing things, of which we're not going to get a chance to get it all into the show. But safe to say, the problems that Powell has now compared with his hero, Paul Volcker, are magnified, well, 1,700 times, because the size of the excess reserves in the banking system are quite enormous. We're talking about $3.2 trillion. So whether you move interest rates by 25 basis points or 50 or 100 basis points as well, the magnitude of the effect on that is so limited when there is such a vast amount of excess reserves in the system because of the ramifications of global quantitative easing. And that's just in the United States as well. So you get the issue here. There is so much money available to lend sloshing around the system. We see it in the stock market every day. We see it in the housing market every day. We see it in real estate. And so hence it has a much more difficult job thereafter for Neil Kashkari, for Jay Powell, for Rafael Bostic, et cetera, and Mary Daly. So you can see their reticence. Even if you don't like their reticence, you can see it. All right, let's move on. US initial jobless claims hit a 2-month high last week. At a higher than expected 221,000. But the problem there is, it's always nuanced, isn't it? The continuing claims fell slightly to 1.79 million. Now, that is ahead of yet again the all-important jobs report, with analysts polled by Reuters expecting jobs growth to slide to 200,000. Well, I've seen a higher figure from some of the big investment banks, so it could be anywhere. Let's be honest about it. It was 275,000 in February. So let's get to that interview I had with Nomura's chief economist, Richard Koo, here at the Ambrosetti Forum, and I asked whether markets should be focused on central bank policy beyond the timing of rate cuts. Listen in.
Central banks typically have two tools to tighten monetary policy: raise interest rates or squeeze the availability of reserves. And Paul Volcker, whom I worked under many, many years ago, and he's apparently the hero for Mr. Jay Powell, actually used the second one. He actually squeezed the availability of reserves. Banks didn't have much excess reserves. They scrambled to get their reserves in the interbank market. Federal funds rate went to 22%, killed the economy, killed inflation, in that order. This time around, I'm afraid Chairman Powell does not have the second option, because there's so much excess reserves in the banking system. The amount of excess reserves in the U.S. banking system is more than 1,700 times larger than before the Lehman crisis. And so an amount is something like $3.2 trillion. So if you try to tighten with this tool, you have to remove the $3.2 trillion first before you will have any grip on the situation. And of course, you cannot do that overnight. So that means all the efforts on monetary tightening were on interest rates, because you cannot use the other tool. These tools are, of course, not completely independent.
Wasn't that fascinating? If you don't find that fascinating, you're watching the wrong channel. Anyway, I spoke to Richard Koo about the outlook also for the US economy and the potential impact of Donald Trump returning to the White House and why people vote for Donald Trump. Again, listen in.
I'm against protectionism. I think it's a horrible thing. But I have to say that Trump's argument does have economic logic. And that is that when we studied economics, free trade in particular, we were taught, I think you were taught, I was taught this way, that free trade always creates both winners and losers in the same economy. But the gain the winners get is always greater than the loss of the losers. So the society as a whole always gains. So that's why our free trade is good. But none of the professors told us that this is actually predicated on one key assumption. And the key assumption is that the trade is either in balance or in surplus. In that case, this condition holds. This conclusion holds. But if it's running a huge deficit year after year, decades after decade, which was the case in the United States, over 40 years of continuously running huge trade deficits, the number of losers begins to grow. And by 2016, the number of people who consider themselves losers of free trade were large enough to elect Trump president. And so we have to really go back and say to ourselves, what did we do wrong to allow this many people in the United States to feel themselves as losers of free trade? And I think the key problem is with the exchange rate. We kind of let the exchange rate decided by market, so-called market forces, speculators, my clients, Wall Street types. But foreign exchange rate had to be set in a way that the number of losers do not grow to a point where the free trade itself is lost.
Do you see any economic rationale at the moment from either side that actually could avert more protectionism or actually working internationally on exchange rates? Do you see anything that's going to happen on a global basis, global cooperation or within the United States itself, which will avert more protectionism?
So we have to graduate from this notion that U.S. trade deficit is all due to too much investment in the United States, too few savings in the United States. That view kind of dominates the Western academia. Mm-hmm. And if that is true, the only way to reduce U.S. trade deficit is for U.S. to go into recession and remain in recession so that domestic demand would be so weak and the U.S. would be able to export more goods. But in a democratic in a democracy, that's an impossible situation, that you have to be in recession all the time just so that the trade balance will be balanced. And this is actually, in my view, completely wrong view of what actually happened. Because if that view is true, when U.S. was dealing with the Japanese companies were arguing that we are just filling the gap that U.S. companies cannot fill. The demand in your country is too big, and that's why we're just filling it in.
Yeah.
If that argument is really true, then American companies fighting the Japanese back in 70s and 80s should have huge profits. The capacity utilization has to go in through the roof because there's so much demand. But that did not actually happen. It's the opposite that happened. So many of them went bankrupt. So many losers of free trade were left in the streets because it was not a savings and investment issue. It was the exchange rate issue. The dollar should have been much weaker. And Reagan understood that. That's why he took that action.
my takeaway from that is like, yeah, protectionism is bad, but free trade isn't always work, you know, and that's being really apparent, isn't it, for millions of Americans as well. Tina Fordham is founder of Fordham Global Foresight and is a great person to follow on from Richard Kuh as well, because something that you briefly talked about with me just a second ago, as I was listening into Richard at the same time, is that the economy potentially should be putting wind in the sails of Joe Biden. It is not putting wind in the sails of Joe Biden. And I think Richard has nailed a few of the points, and actually the free trade situation, these enormous deficits, the trade deficits, are just leaving millions of Americans, not necessarily with the same kind of jobs that their fathers and their grandfathers and their grandmothers had as well, but it's leaving them feeling disenfranchised from the boom that the US economy is feeling.
I have so many things to say about that. I mean, the first point is that when it comes to economic data, there's just a lag time before the man on the street starts to feel it. So the wind in the sails, yes, by the time November rolls around, Americans very well may be feeling more positive about the economy. I don't think that explains, though, the fact that the, you know, the incumbent, President Biden, who's got a pretty enviable set of economic circumstances, is not getting the love from that. There are many factors that feed into it. Well known, of course, things like polarization, etc. There are many voters who won't vote for Joe Biden no matter what the state of the economy is. But the point is that it wasn't that long ago that when it came to elections, the old saw was, it's the economy, stupid. And it isn't anymore. I would argue it hasn't been for some time.
Yeah, and there's some other key issues which we'll come to. Roe versus Wade is very important. Immigration is very important as well. But just staying on the economy for our viewers for the moment time, Richard was saying, look, he's against protections. Most of us who work in this sphere, you and I have worked in finance for a long time.
Yes,
a long time. Let's just put it like that between us. And we've always been taught, and as Richard, we've always been taught, free trade is good. But he's like turning it on his head. Free trade is good up to a point. And free trade has left millions of Americans not feeling that they're part of this boom time as well, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or Republican in the White House.
Janet Yellen spoke about this the other day, about her kind of regret in you know, it's economics 101, isn't it? Cheaper goods are good for everybody, and you should send the country that sent them to you a thank you note. And as it turns out, more cheap stuff didn't make people feel more prosperous and didn't make them feel thankful. And so peak globalization in the US was quite some time ago. And we can see it's, you know, not a causal correlation, but let's call it a vibe shift in people's feelings about their future and about their children's future, the American dream that your children will have a better standard of living than you have. In Asia and in other places where globalization is still, you know, running with progress, people feel much more optimistic. And so there's something in the idea that it's not necessarily your kind of net wealth and living standards, it's the sense of momentum that feeds into people's sense of, you know, happiness, contentment, etc.
Tina, I'm delighted you've discovered the joy of Ambrosetti. It's your because I've been privileged to be coming here for many, many years, and I think it's a stunningly important conversation we're already having here at CNBC as well. But the great and the good of Europe, of which there are a lot of them here, they are in terror of what a Trump presidency means as well. But when you talk to the great and the good in North America, they are more nuanced about how they see a second Trump administration. Do you want to just break down the difference in that intellectual and top-level C-suite thinking?
It's really fascinating to observe as an American who's been living in the UK and talking to you know, an EMEA client base mainly for such a long time, for over 20 years. And Wall Street investors and US politicians don't really get it. We had a poll here on who the attendees would like to see as the next U.S. president. It wasn't Donald Trump. Then the question came, who do you think will be the U.S. president? Donald Trump. And so this reflects my conversations. The sense here is that almost an inevitability about a second term for Trump. Americans don't think that. I think most Americans would agree that this, you know, this race is still wide open. And so, first of all, there's a kind of a you know, preparing themselves for Europe of Trump presidency, but it doesn't mean for European business leaders what it does for U.S. business leaders. What their fears are tariffs, obviously, and overarching concern about security.
Yeah.
Europe is the most exposed to changes in the sort of U.S. security alliances. Arguably, Donald Trump has done more for NATO than any U.S. president could have. Putin and Trump between them have boosted European spending considerably, and Putin has added more member states. So NATO is more robust than ever. But it's that security guarantee that Europeans worry about. They're not thinking about the economic benefits. It's hard to say what sort of dividends there would be for Europe.
Yeah, I've just come back from Warsaw with the team, actually, and have robust conversation with both the foreign minister and the president, who's like, they're not waiting for the Americans. They're spending 4% of GDP and building up a massive army. I want to go backwards because you made a very important point, which we haven't gone further down the road with yet, about the issues that the Americans are voting on. And it's not the economy, stupid, which is the quote goes back to the Clinton administration staff as well. What is it then? I offered a couple of ideas, but you tell me what you think.
Well, I think the honest answer is that this kind of conundrum is really mystifying U.S. pollsters who have their work cut out for them this time. Another point, you know, that's useful for a non-U.S. audience is the rise of RFK Jr. And the role that third-party candidates will play. RFK Jr. is doing rather well on what is a solidly anti-vax platform, plus a lot of government intervention. So this flies in the face of, again, that Econ 101 thinking about what people will vote their pocketbook. What it says about the American electorate is not clear. It's not a clear signal. And of course, we don't have the answer yet. I've argued that we're not going to have a clear signal, at least about who will run the country on November 6th, because of the number of wild cards at play. But an anti-vax campaigner backed by Silicon Valley money that is a big state interventionist who may run on a Libertarian Party platform, possibly getting 15% of the vote?
Tina, I'm just going to squeeze in 30 seconds with you as well. I know you don't want to talk about markets because you're looking at the things, but if we don't get a clear candidate in November, and this goes forward beyond the end of the year as well, markets will take that incredibly badly. Begun to get a little bit more nervous in the last week or so. That's the worst case scenario for markets, isn't it?
It's going to look different than Bush-Gore, which led to several weeks of very mild market wobbles, you know, 20-something years ago, as it was, the hanging chads in Florida and the recounts. And what is the key variable? The potential for violence, I think. Even though markets didn't blink when the Capitol building was burning, which was fascinating, the fact that civil unrest could follow a contested result, or a long delay. I would argue for a long delay with recounts, possible Supreme Court referral, but democracy depends on one thing: the loser accepts the result. And if such a large share of the American electorate don't believe in institutions and think the system is rigged, that becomes less likely.
Yeah. I'll just give a quick anecdote to everyone. I was sitting here with Lindsey Graham a year or so ago. I said, you know, prospects of Trump running again, it was dim, distant then. And he said, look, he said he can run and he can win. But and this is the words of Lindsey Graham here in Ambrosetti to our viewers. He's just got to knock off the stuff about January the 6th. Stop talking about that as well, because actually he's just got to accept that as well. And to this day, it's arguable that he hasn't accepted. Tina, lovely to see you.
Likewise.
Thank you so much indeed for your time. We're slumming it, you know, but someone's got to do it, you know. So Tina Fordham, founder of Fordham Global Foresight. And Tina mentioned Mandy, Janet Yellen, and you obviously also want to talk about the Janet Yellen address.
Yes, absolutely, because as you've been sitting there and chatting with Tina, Janet Yellen has been addressing the American Chamber of Commerce live in Guangzhou, as we can see there on the screen. So let me run through some of the things that she has been saying. Indeed, of course, she's there on a visit to China, and she says that China is just too large to try to export its way to rapid growth, and that it would benefit by reducing its excess industrial capacity that is pressuring other economies. Rather pointed comments there. She says she does understand the Beijing's direct and indirect government support for manufacturing is linked to domestic development objectives. However, she says it is currently leading to production capacity that is significantly exceeding China's domestic demand, as well as what the global market can bear. She's also been making some comments along the lines of concerns that have been voiced by American and international companies about a deteriorating business climate in China, which she says includes unfair treatment compared to local competitors, which is kind of interesting because just in the last couple of weeks, China also said that it's going to go to some effort to try to level the playing field and treat American and international companies the same as domestic counterparts. So that actually is a very interesting comment that Yellen clearly feels that that is not the case yet. Some other things that she's been saying is that China would benefit from eliminating barriers and coercive actions on U.S. firms. So Arabile, I think it's fair to say that, you know, she's coming in and she's making America's point clear here. The Chinese have set a 5% target for their growth this year, which a lot of people feel is way too ambitious. And I think the IMF has only got it at about 4.6% this year and falling down to 4.1% next.
I think the sentiment is clear. They're just worried about the exportation of inflation ultimately to the rest of the world. Yes. Is pretty much what Janet Yellen is speaking about. But we'll get into this one as well throughout the show. But coming up, President Biden toughening his stance on Israel as global concerns grow over the country's actions in Gaza. Plus, Samsung's forecasting a tenfold increase in first quarter profit. That comes amid a recovery in chip prices. And Steve, of course, as you've seen, is live all day from the shores of Lake Como. We'll bring you his conversation with Allianz Chief Economic Advisor Mohamed El Erian. That's coming up at 7:30 CET.
Ambition to me is about doing better.
I think ambition creates a pathway.
The best advice I can give someone starting off a career is don't have a career, have lots of careers, try loads of different things.
Talk to people and put your ambition out there.
I don't feel that I've hit peak ambition because it's a learning journey.
CNBC is where ambition meets opportunity. What does living ambitiously mean to you? Hear it from our CNBC anchors, reporters and global business leaders on CNBC.com.
Now, Israel will open two new aid routes into Gaza after Joe Biden informed Prime Minister Netanyahu that U.S. policy on the region will hinge on its assessment of Israel's immediate action to protect innocent Palestinians and aid workers. Now, two U.S. officials told NBC News the president strongly implied conditioning military aid to Israel. This was Biden's first contact with the Israeli leader after the country killed seven aid workers in strikes it described as a mistake on Monday. Almost 33,000 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the war. The frosting of relations is the latest in a series of developments which threaten further instability in the region after Iran vowed to retaliate amid a suspected Israeli airstrike on the country's embassy in Damascus. All of this, of course, has brought oil a lot higher than even $91 a barrel is the price of Brent crude oil as we're currently seeing it now. It's up 40 cents just this morning alone. It, of course, has been on a tear of late. WTI nearing $87 a barrel. Dan Murphy joining us for a little bit more on this one. Dan, well, there certainly are ruptures sort of happening between the U.S. and Israel. The U.S. still supplies quite a significant portion to that funding for defense spending out of Israel. Could that change?
That's the big question right now, isn't it, Arabelle? President Biden told Prime Minister Netanyahu these strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation in Gaza is unacceptable. And the White House also says that the president made clear that Israel must announce and implement immediate actions now to protect civilians and address humanitarian concerns. Otherwise, U.S. policy towards its ally will change. Now, what that looks like remains to be seen at this point, but here's Secretary of State Antony Blinken outlining the U.S.'s primary concerns.
The leaders discussed the situation in Gaza. The president emphasized that the strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation are unacceptable. He made clear the need for Israel to announce a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. He made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. He underscored as well that an immediate ceasefire is essential to stabilize and improve the humanitarian situation and protect innocent civilians, and he urged Prime Minister Netanyahu to empower his negotiators to conclude a deal without delay to bring the hostages home.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken there. We still don't know what measures, if any, the U.S. is prepared to take against if Israel, if it fails to comply with these demands for a ceasefire and progress on hostage releases. But this call to action, some 6 months after the war started, is being seen as perhaps more symbolic than meaningful, given the U.S. is still authorizing major weapon sales to Israel. And at the same time, questions also being asked now about just how credible President Biden's call for an immediate ceasefire is, given the historic reluctance of the U.S. to pressure Israel in any significant way, even after so much death and suffering over the course of this last 6 months. Of course, it's important to point out here that Israel has pledged to investigate the death of those aid workers this week. It's also committed to opening crossings for more aid into Gaza, but critically here, it has not provided a timeline, so we watch and wait for more details on that. But as we look at the overall equity and commodity impact of this, of course, all of this after a week of high tensions in the region, with Iran also blaming Israel and threatening revenge after a strike in Syria that killed a top IRGC commander. And that's why we have seen this new geopolitical price premium being added to the crude complex here, with Brent now above $90 a barrel.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market moving news, you can head to cnbc.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.